Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 17th, 1999, and in the Creekside Room this morning, Joel Oinas continues his series, Conversations in the Shade of the Tree of Life. Today's session will be dealing with science and public life. This is tape 99-7. So let's join Joel now for discussion and maybe a little lecture.
Now, and let's do it with a prayer. Creator God, you have created us each in your image, but you have put us in community. And we have, since the Tower of Babel, struggled to understand and live in community. Christ came and created one and died so that it could become one. Give us that vision and your spirit so that we may continue the ministry of reconciliation and live in your community. In Christ's name, amen. Yesterday we talked about science, faith, and private life, and or personal life. I don't like to use the word private because as the dynamic natural theology that's emerging and as science has shown us, we are not capable of living alone, that we are dependent upon not only each other, as our economy has demonstrated, but also on every creature and plant on the globe in some one way or another. And so we talked about how one, first of all, can use basic science and simple science to get to understand your community, natural and human, and your use of resources and your production of waste by just counting it, keeping track of the meters on your house, getting to know what's there, getting to know what you use, and finding out where it goes when you're done with it. And that brings us right away into public life, because as we noticed very quickly, when we talked about the good life and we talked about what we needed to preserve, infrastructure came up that we need if we're going to live in reduced circumstances for the sake of the health of our earth. We will still need, and we may even be more dependent upon things such as transportation, communication, sanitation. And so we move right away into faith and the public life. And the most immediate steps one can take in their personal life, if you're going to respond to the scientific discoveries and the mathematical certainties of expanding population and limited resources, is decision to move your own life into a more sustainable direction personally. You know, your family, your household, your day-by-day life. That also provides an example for others. And never underestimate the power of example, an example to persuade. I have found that in a small town, and my little town is 600 people, it's been demoralized for the last 50 years as businesses have upped and moved away, as the services that used to be offered in this little town, like a dentist, a doctor, 3 hardware stores, 4 grocery stores, it's all been reduced to a gas station and a grocery store. All those things, you know, the town has sort of declined and resources have gone elsewhere, and people just figure they don't know anything, and they have this vague feeling that they've done something wrong. They're just village folk. And the power of an example, someone comes in and someone is optimistic, you know, creates a group that of citizens that volunteers for something. And it doesn't take but 2 people in a town that size to kind of change the entire mood. It may be, people may be more cynical and have more reasons to resist that in the city. I don't know. I've gotten kind of prejudiced against urban life. But the possibility and the importance of an example is enormous. And I think that exemplary behavior is one of the responsibilities of the church. If you look at the earliest talk in the book of Acts, and the book that you were referring to yesterday, there was a book about the growth of the Christian church,
The
Rise of Christianity. Both of them report that that it was the exemplary behavior of Christians, their generosity with one another, their willingness to have less and hold things in common, that really moved and influenced those around them. They, you know, there were several times in the book of Acts said that they had favor with all the people, that somehow people looked and said, my. And I think that's the same argument between the year 200 and 300, why the church grew at such an astounding rate, and why the whole Western Europe became, or, you know, was sort of intrigued and enamored of Christianity. So the power of an example is an important thing. And the ethic of the church has been one of generosity. And I'm just talking about the church and not necessarily the New Testament, but it's the ethic of the church has developed based on generosity and neighbor love. And the word for a long time was charity. And it has its roots in the voluntary poverty of Jesus. You know, that Jesus, he didn't say rich people should help out the poor. He told the one rich ruler that came, sell everything you have and follow me, asking not that he be just a merely generous person, but that he engage in the life of blessed poverty. So that's the beginning of the tradition. It has been adapted to a very affluent West, to where it is to where it accommodates and provides an ethic for those people who are not poor and don't intend to be. You know, we're sort of middle class. The church, I don't think, includes the very rich or the extremely desperately poor in our nation, but we're all sort of, you know, the Pharisaic middle class. We know how to get things done. We have watches. We organize, and it's almost in spite of ourselves and our ethic that we become middle class and sort of affluent. We just are competent. You know? I mean, that's maybe a compliment, but maybe it's one of the problems we have in the church. And so it's been adapted, and so and it's never been said better than by John Wesley, who said, the ethic of the church should be earn all you can, save all you can, and give all you can. Well, we've sort of perfected the first. And capitalism, the capitalists are sort of worried that they've made very good consumers out of us, but we aren't very good at saving. And you have to have people that'll do both, to have investment and sales. And they're worried that people aren't investing enough. Well, at least they were 5 years ago. So Wesley's ethic, earn, save, and give all you can, it's a fairly adapted ethic for people who are well off. And the centerpiece of the church's action on behalf of the poor in the world has been, while ignoring the two-tiered society, the rich and the poor, they have done charitable relief, you know, have really worked and responded to disasters. When people are hungry or dying, the church can be relied on, absolutely, to come and be generous. Okay? And it's a generosity out of an abundant or generous personal life. The church has organized these significant efforts. But and then with that, there is another, that ethic is important, what I want to say today. And this other ethic, which is probably adapted from the Reformation, and Jim is our population expert in the village. You may have something to say about this. But the idea of freedom and human rights probably emerged from the Reformation and the rise of individualism. And Luther proposed a dialectic full of tension. John Schramm made reference to a tension in life between. And I think that what I'm going to talk about is related. But Christians, Luther proposed that the Christian as an individual could not claim rights for themselves. Interesting. said, as a member of the community of faith, the gospel demands that a Christian be self-sacrificing and that they do not look out for their own interests. But on behalf of their neighbor, they vigorously defend and advocate for one's neighbor, for their rights and their well-being. And so there was this tension. There was the kingdom on the left was servanthood, death and resurrection, and a self-sacrifice, even unto death. And on the kingdom on the right, the theater of public policy that strove for peace and justice and intervened on behalf of those that needed protection and help. And out of that, the idea of defending the rights of one's neighbors, that also has been adapted to where the general assumption of human rights includes the important part, my rights. And Christians will talk about my rights. And it's become sort of endemic in our society that the tension is gone. I think Christians who have struggled with this as a matter of faith understand how they must deny themselves and seek the rights of others, and that's a tension. But I think society as a whole has just really liked the idea of one's own personal rights, and that has become sort of the political sort of the talisman. You know, my rights will not be stepped on, and. And so that's connected with, I think, with freedom and individualism. And I saw a huge ballooning of that in 1980 when Ronald Reagan was elected. I'm not a Democrat or Republican, but it seems to me that where that sort of selfishness, that's what it was called earlier, that all of a sudden it became a primary virtue in our society, the idea of looking out for oneself, this self-interest. You know, you only go around once and you got to grab all the gusto. So we have this, and that has been adapted for, so we have these two assumptions. We have this freedom, this idea of freedom and rights that has been adapted so that people can look after their own rights. And oftentimes that takes so much time, you've lost the ability or the interest in looking after the rights of others. And this idea of charity and this general assumption that both of those are sort of sacred rights has led to a scenario that presents enormous problems for science involved in sustainability. It's an unexpected obstacle, this peculiar and sacred right of rights. And the right, the specific right that we'll talk about today is the right to have children. Okay? That is what universal and irrevocable in most cultures and nations, no matter how stressed and unsustainable a population may be, to interfere with a birthright, the right to produce children. It is a very radical step. I think China has done it.
Mm-hmm. India tried to do it. India, Gandhi bounced out of office.
Yeah, it was politically unacceptable. So we have this, what is nearly a universal and irrevocable right to produce children, no matter what economic shape you are or your nation is in. And then the moral obligation of rich people, nations, to save lives is, we would consider, absolute and undeniable. Now, it's a little different than the ethic of Jesus, which said, you be poor and work out of your poverty. But the adapted version says, we who have should always help those when life is in danger. And that is absolute and undeniable, right? And the argument is that human ecologists acknowledge the good intention of each of those, but together, it's a fatal recipe. If both are pursued consistently, and assuming for the minute that the well-off will really take this seriously. I'm not sure that it's ever, we're very happy with the two-tiered society, and there's lots of effort to keep it intact. But assume that the church were willing to go to any extreme to make sure people survived. And Garrett Hardin estimates that Well, he's written a couple of times about cultural carrying capacity, saying that if you eat bread and water, if everyone is reduced to bread and water, if the rich become generous enough that they will sacrifice all their assets, all their sort of privileged assets for the sake of the poor, we could get 50 billion people on this planet living on bread and water. Well, you know, there's some science behind it. I don't know what kind of measuring and counting they did. But what that does is leave a society that has no reserves, that has, well, education would be given up, and so unprepared to meet any further crisis. And you can just imagine beyond that, population would increase, disasters would, and there'd be very little in the way of an intelligentsia to approach the problems. Okay, so it's a fanciful scenario because we have not at all consistently believed that that saving lives is an absolute and undeniable right or an obligation. And we've been content with this two-tiered society where a minority has a high quality of life and enjoys the good life, and the rest of the world is steeped in poverty and always in danger of starvation and death. But suppose we were to be consistent about life-saving charity, and that these two, this two-tiered existence of the rich and the poor were absolutely and undeniably intolerable, that we, as a primary ethic would say, to be have rich and poor in the world is unacceptable. And to try to achieve a level, a standard of life, a quality of life that was attainable by everyone, what would that just, sustainable, attainable, good life look like? Robert Malthus, he said 200 years ago, he said, there should be no more people in a country than can enjoy a daily glass of wine and piece of beef for dinner. Cultural carrying capacity says that's not going to be 50 billion people. Now, that's 200 years ago, and we have different opinion on how pieces of beef for dinner. As a contrast to that 50 billion that Garrett Hardin proposed as the absolute limit for subsistence human population, there's Earth First. An Earth First ethic says that human impact in the natural world should be negligible. It should not even make a difference to the rest of the animals. And so they propose the population of the late Neolithic, or the Paleolithic period, 200 million people max, no more. That's one of their objectives. Now 50 billion, 200 million. And so we're talking about the science of carrying capacity. So what human ecologists are saying, first thing you have to do is determine what is that standard of life you want. If we let these two ethics, the ethics of irrevocable right to have children, the absolute and undeniable responsibility of the rich to look after the poor, what happens is that the poor come and say, we need food. The rich decide, well, we can do without our symphony orchestras. So money is saved, no one goes to symphonies, the money is spent, more children are born. You know, this is a fanciful human ecologist scenario. It says, we still need more food. Well, we'll stop higher education, you know, no more graduate school. You have to be content with a BA. Okay, so there's some more resources freed up that way. And then more children are born, and it says, okay, what else can you give up for us? And I'd say, well, college. We'll give up college. We'll content ourselves with homeschooling in high school. You can see how the scenario unfolds, that if people are absolutely committed to making sure people have enough to stay alive, the two-tiered society will eventually even out. And we'll all be there without any resources, and 50 billion of us, and when the next disaster strikes, there's no more to give. Human ecologists say we have to consider a cultural carrying capacity. And it's somewhere more than 200 million, unless Earth First finally wins the political battles and enforces population control or, you know, makes war against humanity, or the 50 billion. And And so the first question one has to ask is, and I think this is what I'm going to ask you to do. Let me say just a few more things. The science of carrying capacity would have to depend upon determining an accurate and fairly precise cost per annum for the good life that we can all obtain. And it would require, first of all, a description of that and a decision on how big the population that would correspond to that would be. Now, I'm not suggesting that we have any of the mechanisms in place to do that. But then what would happen is that those who are lower than that standard of living, the quality of life, would be raised, and those who are above it would be lowered to it. Now, I'm not an expert, but my observations say that there's no problem in offering the poor a better standard of living or quality of life. They're eager for it. They will do it. The problem comes in asking the upper of the two tiers to lower their standard of living, maybe not necessarily their quality of life, so that we can all obtain, you know, a just style of life. And so what I wanted to ask you to do is talk amongst yourselves about this. First of all, you may have to just talk about whether you want to give up the two-tiered society. I think that's as Christians, we're almost forced to do that. We don't have any, you know, Jesus did say, the poor you will have with me always, you'll have with you always. But he didn't say, you also have the rich with you always. You know, he was making some messianic statement I don't understand, but that's the only quote I hear thrown in my face about that. That's the justification for keeping 70% of the world in poverty, is that Jesus said they'd always be there, so I guess we better see to it. But there is no biblical justification for a church that is fairly well off doing emergency charity. So the first thing, discuss that. Then number one, the broad outlines of a basic standard lifestyle. Now, I know there are problems with suggesting that we have a uniform lifestyle, but think about that, okay? The broad outlines of a standard lifestyle that's attainable by all. What steps you take to raise the poor to that standard, and what steps you think need to be taken to lower the expectations and the lifestyle of those above it. And four, what do you think's maybe we should ask Jim, what do you, to finally estimate the population that one could sustain at that level. Maybe Jim, you want to make some comments about that now? Or?
No, that's okay.
Okay. All right. So is that clear enough, or did I sort of set things up for failure?
He basically wants to solve all the world's problems.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking.
I just wanted to clarify, that's what you're asking.
And we have 10 minutes.
Seven, I think.
So
yeah.
To keep us focused, could you put like 3 points on the marker board?
Yeah, and I hate to call it a standard lifestyle, but, you know, it maybe describes what I'm after. I mean, it's sort of a radical idea.
It's
like
sustainable
minimum,
lifestyle.
You're talking about what is a minimum and a maximum in terms of where a lifestyle ought to fit in between that?
Well, you can do it that way, or maybe just say, if I had to tell the world tomorrow what people could have and couldn't, you know, if I just had to solve this problem tomorrow.
So this is for the world's population as it exists today.
Yeah.
A sustainable lifestyle for everybody.
Yeah. Well, what I think we have to imagine is how, you know, we have a better understanding of the things that make for the good life. You know, well, I think when it comes to music, when it comes to art, I mean,
who's we?
I don't know, Western folks, maybe not. When it comes to the material things, the things that we use resources for, we've seen it all. We've made some very bad choices. But
so you're saying we have an idea of what might?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't even say that.
On the basis of our mistakes, we have a better sense of what we should.
I'm not saying it's justified at all, but we've enjoyed the work of artists in our communities. We've had great music produced, and it's not saying that others haven't. I think
really bad at like community art and community based.
Exactly. When we think of music, we think of Best Buy and the CD collection right? And so I should maybe leave it more open than that. What the good life may not be have any correspondence to what we have decided it is. I mean, culturally. I mean, all of our consumer goods and our. So I do sense that I've sort of violated.
I think there was an assumption you made earlier that really bothers me.
Sure.
That makes me feel like this is really hopeless, and you pretty much said the poor are a bottomless pit. That we could, you know, we could.
And that's not my opinion. But human ecologists and scientists are that's the way they paint the disaster.
But if we go on that assumption that the poor are a bottomless pit, that we could scale our lifestyle down.
Yeah, and that's an arrogant sort of thing to do.
I don't see any hope. I mean, what's the point of discussing that?
And I think it's fanciful. I
think part of the problem is wealth and poverty are relative terms. And some of the people that would fit in the category of poor today, 200 years ago, might have had a lifestyle that wasn't too different than the lifestyle they're living now. It would certainly not have described their lives as necessarily poor. And in fact, if you measure happiness in those different cultures, you find that often it's the poor who are very happy. Please don't hear me wrong. I'm not suggesting that means you should ignore them and disregard their malnutrition or their poor oral health or dental health or anything like that. But still, wealth and poverty, I mean, I can think of myself as poor in relationship to Bill Gates, but obviously in relationship to the rest of the world, I'm filthy rich. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the problem. With the first question was that the two-tier thing, I'm not sure that we'll ever be able to eradicate wealth and poverty, or the concepts of wealth and poverty, richer and poorer. And I doubt that's what Jesus meant. I don't know what he meant either in that reference. You always have the poor with you. So that's where Jennifer's reference to minimum and maximum, I think, is more realistic. I think we will always have a range of wealth and income, or wealth and power.
Mm-hmm. Exegetically, that reference may reference you back to Deuteronomy 15:11, which is a whole structure of the economy, which ironically says the beginning of the chapter, if you follow these statutes, ordinances, and commands which I give you this day, you will have no poor among you. Because it's the structure of Deuteronomy. But then it says the poor will never cease out of the land, therefore you never cease your obligation to them.
So you should always be concerned with the
Well, least. Yeah, you never are out of that obligation, is how I read that.
Yeah, sure, so that's very helpful.
Okay.
But the other thing that I think it ties in here, I'm interested in the assumptions that you gave, and unless I turned to Jim with population background, it was in what little I've read about people who made efforts at population control contend that the major factor that drives population growth is the sense that I need some social security, and that is that of my children. So I need to assure that children will outlive me, so that I have someone to take care of me, and that often when the economic situation changes, population begins to be under control. So the thought that coming down and leveling out at 50 billion is problematic, or is it? I don't know.
Well, right now, October 12th, the UN will celebrate an arbitrary day.
Celebrate.
The 6 billionth person will be born.
Celebrate?
Well, at least commemorate the day.
Where children are always welcome.
You know, everybody all gasped together. The whole world will go,
Wow. See, I don't know. I certainly believe that population growth exacerbates a lot of problems on the planet. But I'm concerned about misanthropic views that allow us to regard that day as a day for morning rather than for, you know, I mean, we would.
I don't see why you call it misanthropic. I just think it's just a realism that's saying, you know, not to be an Earth first or anything.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. There are folks like that, and I know that isn't necessarily what you were saying, but. Right now, the way the statistics look is fertility has been declining for the last 50 years, down from well over 6 to down very near 3. And it's on track to continue to decline. Now, the problem is the gains now will be harder to achieve. Mm-hmm. And the other side of it is, when you get away from demographics, it's the economic impact of those that are being born today, is particularly in Asia, as people with subsistence lifestyles aspire to what we have, and why shouldn't they? Mm-hmm. That's the problem today, is that we have a large number of people who are reaching the reproductive years of their lives, and we're experiencing what's called demographic momentum. We have about 35% of the world's population under the age of 15. And they're just going to do what you did when you turned 15, you know, rage around full of hormones looking for a mate.
It's one of those vocations.
And so, but realize this, you have a larger number of people, it's a triangle, you have a larger number of people at reproductive age, but when they engage in reproductive activity, they are not breeding like rabbits. Instead of having 6.6 like their parents or, well, their grandparents had, they're having 3.3 on average. Now it's closer to, that's on average, so developed and developing combined. If you're in the developing world, quote, it's closer to 3.8, and if you're in the developed world, it's in some places it's negative, it's below 2. So, I think there's lots of reason for hope. I think that there's lots of reason to believe that once we get past this, because what precipitated all of this was the introduction primarily of modern hygiene, modern antibiotics that lowered the death rate and allowed people to survive. And so, I mean, is that so bad? You know,
no.
I mean, this is a consequence of our own doing. It's there are a lot of severe consequences that were wrought by good intention, and over time we're seeing the curve start to come down. Whether we'll ever really reach stabilization is debated, but right now that's what the UN wants you to think or wants you to believe. And so right now the projection is that yes, we'll grow by 50%, we'll be 9 billion by the year 2050, but that you get out to 2150 will be stabilized.
Let me just say a word here. I tried to represent what little I know about the scientific view of this sustainability of the population. And you immediately, and I think it's a good sign, recognize that the issue is simplified. You know, that the church maybe has a better understanding of what's at stake here, in terms of compassion, in terms of variety, in terms of diversity, than scientists that look at the big picture and do the number crunching. And so I feel a little bit chastened, but I'm also very grateful that he said, wait a minute, you know, it's not as simple as just setting up a standard lifestyle. But maybe let me rephrase the question that we can work on then. It seems that we are still faced, we who live in a consumptive world and who use up an abominably large share of the world's resources, still have a long way to go to discover the good life. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what I guess that might be the best thing to talk about.
What is
now
good life?
The good life. And this will absolutely include a reduction of the kind of resources that you use. But so we're talking about the reduction of our use of material resources that need to be shared among others. But we're not talking and not implying a reduction in the quality of life. Okay? Is that a better way to state it? And can you, how about sitting around together? And I think I have 11:20 now. Is that what the right time? So we're on for till 11:45. Spend a few minutes talking about the quality of life, and the adaptations we that are incumbent upon us to make so that others can, so that there is a lifestyle and an exemplary lifestyle, if we are an example, as the West has always been, of a lifestyle that's not full of nifty consumer gadgets that the world can no longer afford to distribute uniformly, but a lifestyle chosen and a good life that is easy on the earth and that other people can aspire and easily achieve. Is that a better way to say it? So talk. I'll
Will those be graded?
No.
Let's report. Let's hear from the deliberations of the church on solving our emerging problems of sustainability. Speak.
But anyway, our we talk a lot about community. If there was a way that we could get rich people, you know, whatever that means to you know, because most of us are, if we could get ourselves and those, all the Westerners who are afraid of knowing their neighbors and having a community sense and sharing, to experience the good parts of community, that would do a huge amount to change, because that's kind of what's happened in some of our personal lives, that we've seen that, you know, you might have less stuff and less security monetarily, but you understand that if you have less security monetarily, but it's balanced by more people who are there for you in a serious way.
So you're suggesting that the addiction of materialistic acquisition is a function of people's insecurity and lack of community.
Yeah, and also their need to separate themselves in whatever way, physically, you know, by having larger yards and I mean, we didn't talk so
to define themselves and to protect themselves.
Exactly, yeah, in whatever ways, monetarily or physically.
Okay. What do you think? That's a powerful suggestion.
I think there's a lot of truth to
that. That as your community becomes more secure and meets more needs, interpersonal needs and needs of conversation and faith, and that the need for all this stuff sort of becomes less urgent?
Can become less
urgent. Yeah.
Can become.
But I don't think that, I think the hard part is that they can't get there, or we can't get there by being told, you know? Mm-hmm. You got to experience a little of it before you can let go little tiny bits at a time, okay. You know? Because if somebody says, well, you know, you don't need this. What you need is community. When you have your, when you had your privacy and you've done whatever you want, you drive where you want, you spend what you want on what you want, you buy whatever you want in whatever store, no matter where it was made, and you know, you kind of keep your blinders on. And we've all done that to some degree.
Mm-hmm. And this is one of the things I think that Holden has always done, steadfastly done. Everybody who comes up here gets a little taste of that.
Yeah.
And there's just not that much stuff that you can acquire up here,
yeah.
And people see that it does work, and everybody takes on a little germ of the fact that community does make those other things less urgent and less critical, and your fear goes down, and it's a wonderful place that way. Do you think? Well, let's go on with that. You can't just tell people you need community, or you know, you wouldn't need all this stuff. What can the church do, or what can any organization do? How does that message get out?
Well, it can be an example. I think that right there, if communities of faith can take a deep breath and try to do that in their own group. And you know, and then they'll find out how hard it is too, if they haven't been used to it, and maybe be like what you said, like an example to.
Jim suggested, and maybe we get some comments on that. That community that does that discovers the resources in community do make all those materialistic acquisitions less urgent and sort of reduces them, that's going to be a threat to a society and an economy that runs, that depends upon everybody's income and wealth and standard of living depends on people buying these things urgently.
Right.
And a community is going to maybe do less. Yeah. And nothing would anger Madison Avenue more than people who go out and make their own music and bring a potluck and nobody spends anything for 5 or 6 hours. I mean, you could see the threat to the economy if you did that every night. And
right. But that'd be good, I think.
Well,
I think that's also
maybe not. Depends on what you do for a living.
Yeah, that's true.
Do you make violins? Do you make sneakers?
Right.
So maybe you just need to consume differently.
Well, say something about that.
Employed. Well, maybe I buy your CD instead of buying another pair of sneakers.
That'd be great.
See, one out of her pocket.
Yeah, right. Actually, I was thinking the Jennifer CD, you know, the great, great lectures.
There you go.
No, but
I'm really curious about that whole point of, you know, what responsibility do we have to
keep the economic
I mean, I don't feel any responsibility to the big corporations.
They don't feel any responsibility to you.
So yeah, obviously. So what are you talking more on a
I'm just talking about economic reality. Right now, if you don't consume, that means production and inventories go up, and after a while, it makes no sense in producing anymore. So people get laid off, and they have less money. That means less consumption. That means less production.
And to complicate it more, the people who get laid off are going to be the people who are probably the worst off.
Right.
You know, one of the things we briefly talked about was the fact that most of us have money in retirement funds that are counting on us selling computers and everything to the rest of the world.
I'll just speak for myself. I'm a member of the academic elite, and our fund is TIA CREF, and TIA CREF is the primary investor in the Mall of America.
Mm-hmm. We are?
You're kidding. Know where it goes. That's another rule. Know where it goes.
Linda, I think what you're talking about is slow change over time.
Muddling.
Yeah,
muddling.
Yeah, kind of at the edges, you know, buying a little bit less. So the adjustment is slow, so a lot of people don't get laid off all at once. Now, I don't know what Al Greenspan thinks about this.
But, well, anyway, I don't know. I would much rather, and I don't know all the details and stuff, but I would much rather not buy, and not try to taper. I'll say, well, maybe I should go out and buy something today because I don't want these people to get laid off and I don't really need anything. You know, I don't want to do that. Not that I ever need to, because there's always something I want, you know. But I would rather find some way to work for the betterment of the people being laid off than feel like I, you know what I'm saying? I don't know. Is that totally infantile or what?
I think if we focus too much on our consumption and cutting our consumption, that's going to be such a long process. That's not going to help the folks very much who are living in Central America or who are living in Singapore and all that other stuff.
So what helps them?
Revolution.
A muddling revolution.
Bioregionalism, land ownership, is that what you mean? Decoupling from the international economy.
That's what I would probably recommend.
Cash crops and export crops. Exports.
Yeah. On my very limited knowledge, that's probably what I would recommend, but I would probably defer to people who know a lot more.
You know, as consumers, what do we purchase? Do we purchase those type of items, or where does the money go? Does it go to someone else who imports them into this country? Mm-hmm. So as consumers, we need to be educated as to what kind of products are the best ones to buy, not just for ourselves.
Which ones encourage the big infrastructure that is more in line with our mm-hmm. our goals.
Mark,
yes?
I confessed to two of my idolatries
among you, but when I hear about cutting down, two things that really frighten me living without. That, and each of them feeds into a huge infrastructure and a huge organization. One is medical care, and the other is education for my children. And just about everything else, I can imagine if push came to shove, I could let go of. But to live without medical care, to be put in a situation where I have to think twice, thrice, four times before I take a sick child into a doctor, before I have scoliosis treated, before I have, you know, to go to get to such a simple level of living that I don't have that, I can't do that. I don't have enough faith in a community for that. And when it comes up against education for my children, and now I'm talking college. There again, I'm up against the wall. No matter how good a community I have, they cannot provide that for my children. And I don't want to take grants for my kids to go to school that I think rightfully belong to people who don't have the capacity to earn the money to send their kids to school. So that's where the rubber hits the road for me. And I want you to be employed, Jim. Because I want my children to be able to learn from people like you.
I would say that you're in good company. I would say that may be a universal aspiration, that even people without it, given a list, they would choose that first.
Yeah, but that isn't how life works. That isn't how we should prioritize our consumptions. When push comes to shove, it's the educators that pay the least. It's not true about healthcare providers necessarily. But when push comes to shove, we consume other things besides those things that we think are the most valuable. And that's the problem. There is a limited amount of dollars. And so if we consume differently, maybe it would work differently.
But my point is, for someone in my family, either my husband or I, from my point of view, needs to have a job that includes health care. So some romantic idea of moving to a farm and living off the land doesn't really matter. And maybe it's a lack of faith, but I would live in terror.
Can I just make one comment? I mean, I feel like if my friend Daniel Rabezzi was here, he'd feel like I was betraying him right now, that I wasn't making this argument. If you look at it, statistically, there are fewer people living in abject poverty today than there were 50 years ago. The problem is our population's grown, so that number of people, which is 25% of the world's population, is larger than it has ever been. But statistically, and of course, how do you determine wealth and poverty? But there are fewer people, percentage-wise, living in poverty. He would argue that that's because of capitalism, because the pie has gotten bigger, and even though its distribution is woefully inadequate, the little bit that has trickled down has made a difference. And that if you compare what life is like in Singapore today to what it was 25 years ago, you would probably see a marked improvement in the quality of life. Now, that's all. I'm not saying it's true. I'm just putting the argument out there for those of us that want to say, well, we need to decouple from the global economic marketplace, and we need to focus on building our communities and being more ecologically integrated with our bioregion. Well, you know, that the whole Ricardo's emphasis on comparative advantage, that actually it makes more sense for this valley to harvest and export wood than it does to try to grow cotton, is probably a fairly accurate description. And maybe we could trade lumber for food. But you see, you know, so I don't want us to throw that whole thing out and assume that the only way to resolve this inequality is by, you know, hunkering down in bioregionalism or decoupling from this international marketplace, because I think you can make strong arguments that people are better off in general.
But does that, the thing that make, you know, what, I don't know very much about this, but what that makes me think of, that kind of like, well, we might need it, you know, and it's trickling down, that kind of thing, then I always come back to, what about the earth? You know, what about the earth? Because production for production's sake, what is that doing? You know, however many people we have, if we're trashing the earth, and we are, you know, and people are trying their hardest to stop that and to slow it down and that kind of thing, but even at, it's, there's so much that needs to be fixed and changed that I just think, yeah. You know, that feels so intellectual and not, you know, because we're in a finite, I mean, I don't even know how to talk about it, you know what I'm saying?
Right, right. I think those considerations have traditionally been made without a yeah. whole lot of reference to, yeah. The finite resource on the planet, and it does make it more complicated.
Right, if we're all getting cancer because there's too much right. concentration of this, or we're, you know, there's global warming, or, you know, which...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you had your hand up too, Susan.
It would change the direction, so...
Well, it's okay. I just...
Okay. Well, I wanted to respond. I think those two issues, I've had a need for healthcare, and it's been wonderful to have it. I also have the aspiration that my kids go to college, and there is in place, and I think it's a hopeful sign that the public recognizes those universal needs, in that there is a structure in place for the public subsidy of both healthcare and higher education, and anytime that is threatened, we see a real strong response. It's just that we're in a political time where there's been a war conducted on public schools since the 1980s, and they've picked up a lot of social functions that they haven't done before, and we haven't figured out. Well, I think, and also in a time of prosperity, we tend to think we can, you know, get by, but I think those will always be valued by our society and by others, and I don't think that will just be left to the marketplace.
But I do think that we ought to be challenged on that, because I mean the level of healthcare
is bad.
That my healthcare is phenomenal compared to most people in the world, and I'm not sure. I mean, despite the fact that I would love a kidney transplant if I need one. I'm not sure that that's the most just thing to happen in the world. And in terms of my kids going to college, I would love for it to happen. But if you look at the world overall, I mean,
No, I know, it's an ideology.
Yes. Exactly.
I have been facing corneal transplants, and or else I'll be blind.
You too.
And lots of people can be blind in the world, and I understand that, but I don't want 1 month a gap in my health coverage that would mean I have a pre-existing condition, because I would be bankrupt if I had corneal transplants without health care. And, you know, I mean, yeah, that is very high tech, high level, and it's a very Western dream to say if you've got keratoconus, you can have corneal transplants when you need them. But I'll tell you, I want them, I expect help with them, because it would come down to either I could have sight or my kids could have color. Mm-hmm. I wanted to add something to this other high good life. Somebody talked about potlucks and making your own music. A couple of things have happened around music that I think are very interesting. I would say that's part of the good life is music. But public schools don't teach music anymore. It's an early thing to get cut. Mm-hmm. Those who get lessons have private lessons, take money. My mom was a medical technologist. She triple majored in microbiology, French, and music performance at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So, you know, she's too smart for anybody. But she became a pastor's wife and looked in on very little money in Eastern Oregon. Couldn't afford a piano, couldn't afford lessons. None of her 4 children play. So we had a whole generation where that gift of music was lost. And so we packed up a piano for 5 years at Holden, thinking, I'm not going to keep this cycle going. I'm going to find people in a community so that my girls can learn to play the piano during these critical 5 years in their life. Borrowed a piano from my mom and brought it up on a barge is this a necessity or is this an addiction? Living in this community, I could not find people to teach my children the piano. The piano sat there in our house for 5 years, played basically by Tom Wood this year. That really brings home to me this romanticism about potlucks, music, and community. I really believed I was moving to a place where if I had a piano, someone could teach my children how to play. So you can make music, but I bet you had lessons along the way. And, you know, I just don't want us to get too romantic about how things happen, even in community. So now we have a whole other generation in our family that can't play a musical instrument, and that's not going to change at this point at their ages. That's lost to my family, which until my generation was a very musical family. But there was no music in the public schools. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I come back to this. I think to live simply, we have to work in public schools. We have to really be advocate for public schools. Mm-hmm. And we have to, I don't know.
And there, so, that's lunch. That's the lunch.
Yeah, it's a good life. It's potato today.
White rice.
If we all had fewer kids and stopped driving a car, do you have help?